FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. The date is October 24th, 2016. Well, corporate mergers are once again rebounding. A bunch of them happened over the weekend or were announced. WikiLeaks, the drip, 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 death by a thousand cuts to the Hillary Clinton campaign continues on. But don't worry, it was the Russians. Putin, he did it, right? Well, John Rubino with us for our Monday morning chat. John, good morning.
Hey, Kerry. Yeah, we got an unusual one to talk about here. Last week had some stuff happen that that is kind of a departure from the kind of drumbeat of political turmoil and bad economic numbers and stuff like that. And the probably the biggest piece of news, I think what's moving the markets this morning, is all the corporate takeover activity that happened all of a sudden. AT&T is going to take over Time Warner, or, you know, if the regulators let them. Rationally run world, antitrust regulators would never let this kind of concentration happen. But they probably will, because these guys can pay humongous bribes if they need to. And Zero Hedge published a chart over the weekend showing the NASDAQ stock index and showing it peaking just at the last time in early 2000, when Time Warner was bought out by somebody else. Yeah. America Online AOL bought Time Warner.
Right.
Yeah. At the very peak of the market. And, you know, this happens over and over again, where you get these gigantic corporate mergers right at the peak of cycles. And traders, because they're looking fairly short term, traders looking around going, oh, who's next now? Who else will be bought out at a 40% premium to today's stock price? So the stock markets go up because of that. But what it really signals, if you look at history, is the end of the cycle, because these big corporate mergers happen when companies don't really have anything else to do, but they've still got a ton of cash. You know, they can borrow very easily because people are optimistic. They've generated free cash flow for the past few years, but they haven't had anything to do with that cash flow other than buy back their own stock. So they look around and decide to start building empires. You know, the CEO.
Yeah.
Of AT&T now is thinking, wow, if I buy Time Warner, I will be the biggest. I will be the gorilla in the telecom market. Even Google will have to respect me now. You know, so he's thinking of what his legacy will be, that he built the biggest telecom supermarket that has ever existed. All right. And that's always the kind of hubris that leads to catastrophe at the end. And that we're seeing it now is yet another reason why this cycle is probably ending.
It's like the skyscraper index, you know?
Exactly.
Same
exactly.
Difference there.
You know, when egos are out of control and they're combined with basically unlimited access to funds, you get stuff like this. And it usually signals that the cycle is about to end, but it doesn't signal that this is the day that it's going to end. You'll get a lot of knock on M&A from something like this, because all of a sudden everybody is excited. You know, all the investment bankers are calling all the big companies and saying, hey, listen, do you want to take over so-and-so? I think we can get you a pretty good price, only 30% over today's stock price, you know, stuff like that. And the CEOs are listening. They love this kind of stuff. And the bond markets are also listening. They will eat up as much corporate debt as can be issued right now, because corporate debt still pays, you know, 2%, which is a huge interest rate in this world. So, yeah, we'll see a lot more of this stuff in the following weeks and months, but we'll look back on this day as probably the end of the good times and the beginning of the yet another financial crisis. So here it comes, Gary.
Yeah, well, there's not enough corporate debt on the balance sheet and off. We need more, obviously. And there's such opportunities, right? Because we're in such a high growth world. Of course, you want to go take on more and more. And AT&T, they just bought DirecTV a year ago.
Yes.
So they digested that, and damaging it probably like most corporate mergers take place, right?
You know, it's funny. Okay, I'm kind of the quintessential customer of these guys now, because AT&T is my cell phone company, Time Warner is my internet company, and DirecTV is my cable company. Right. So at the end of this process, it's going to be one company that covers my entire telecommunications life.
Aren't you lucky?
And can basically charge me anything they want to from that moment forward, right? Yeah.
Well, pretty much. I mean, well, I will say that, you know, the cable companies pretty much are free to set their prices, because there was that case that said that local and state, county regulators, city cannot set cable rates. That can only be done at the federal level. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the craziest decision, you know, one of those decisions that you just shook your head at and say, I hope somebody did well on this. you know, because there's no justification for it. It's a utility. Utilities get regulated at the state level. I mean, that's the way it works. It doesn't get regulated at the federal level, but somehow the court discovered a right of cable providers to be regulated federally. And, you know, it was in a statute or something. I don't know. I don't remember the case that clearly, but nothing's been the same ever since. The rates on cable have continued to go way beyond the rate of inflation. And, you know, you have to look for deals. But now people are cutting the cord to the cable companies. I talked to several people recently, don't have cable service. They get Netflix, they get Hulu and Amazon. And it's like, you get some free stations if you get an antenna, and you don't need to have to be a captive of the cable companies. So, and you can get HBO and other things without getting cable. So pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Cable's definitely on the wrong side of that technological trend. And, you know, they get that.
Yeah.
So
that's why they're selling alarm monitoring service, and why they sell phone service. Their phone service is pretty darn good, I got to say. They sell phone service and internet. You know, their big thing is selling access. You know, they're an ISP. Internet service mm-hmm. provider. That seems to be their big business now.
And so what they're looking at now is efficiencies when they do these big mergers. They figure, well, you know, we're competitors in these markets, so we can eliminate half of our people and a bunch of our gear if there's just one of us in that market, right? And so we become more efficient, our margins widen out, and our old line businesses survive as cash cows a little while longer. Mm-hmm. And that's not really a great recipe for long-term growth, right? That's more of a managing the decline of old businesses and then hoping your new ones pick up the slack. So it's probable that these guys are, no matter what they do, and, you know, big mergers always turn out to have culture clashes, and it's way harder to get the savings than you thought. And so they don't really work out from a technical execution standpoint anyhow. So it's hard to imagine a combined company, whether they call it AT&T or something else, being a dominant force in these markets 10 or 15 mm-hmm. years from now. You know, they have to find some new stuff to do that is cutting edge. And, you know, they're so big and they're so stodgy that it's highly unlikely that they will be in the class of Google and Amazon at that point. And it's also highly likely that Google and Amazon won't be in the class of whatever comes next, you know, the new Googles and the new Amazons, because that's how markets work. So this is definitely the sign of the end times for this cycle. And the M&A that comes after this is sort of the aftershock of an earthquake, but it's not going to be the sign of good times coming again, like people on Wall Street kind of are deluding themselves about. You know, they see the deal flow and they think that's a sign of good times, when really it's a sign of the end.
Yeah.
Anyhow, lots of other stuff happening too, Kerry. Europe just generated some good news, believe it or not, over the weekend.
From Europe, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, Europe. You know that, you know, Europe, right? That's that place where everything that happens is bad for the financial
markets.
That's
what I thought.
And the political system and everything. But they Portugal got to keep its investment grade rating. You know, it's being rated by as junk by one rating agency, and there were fears that another rating agency would come out and call it junk, which would be the right thing to do, obviously. But That didn't happen. A rating agency reaffirmed its investment grade rating of Portugal's debt, which avoided a mini crisis there where Portugal's debt wouldn't have been appropriate for a lot of accounts and would have caused a little tiny bit of turmoil. And then Spain, which hasn't had a government really for quite a while since it had a disputed election where the various parties couldn't form a coalition to actually run the government. It looks like the socialists are going to step back and let the conservatives form a government now as a way of keeping the actual socialists, the far left parties, out of power. So we get stability in Spain, you know, more of the same, and we get relative stability in Portugal, more of the same. You know, their bonds aren't going to change in any fundamental way in the eyes of the marketplace. And also some halfway decent numbers and some M&A and stuff like that from the economies and from the governments and from the big banks. So all of a sudden, Europe is a source of optimism and good news. But of course, this is also temporary because Europe is a mess. You know, its political systems, the political systems of most of the major European countries can't function with the euro at its current level. So either they dramatically devalue the euro going forward to keep Italy and Portugal and Spain and Greece functioning, or you have a big financial crisis and things spin out of control. But of course, if they devalue the euro really aggressively, that starts the currency war back up again. You know, China's currency already hit a near record low over the weekend versus the dollar, which is a fairly serious warning shot of a new currency war starting. And if the euro gets devalued aggressively and the dollar spikes, then that sucks the life out of our corporate earnings and our economy slows down and we have to respond in kind. So that's the kind of thing that we're looking at in 2017. So most of the news that we're getting now, in other words, is bordering on irrelevant because the big stuff is still broken. And that will come to a head in the not too distant future because we're running up massive numbers. And U.S. manufacturing rebounded a bit last week or last month, and it was reported last week. Now, that can be traced back to the fact that the U.S. government has pumped up its spending in 2016 and dramatically in recent months. You know, the government deficit shot up by like 40% in August, which means that once again, the guys in charge are trying hard to elect their chosen people. In other words, Barack Obama's administration is trying hard to help Hillary Clinton's campaign. This happens pretty much in every election cycle in the U.S. Whoever's in charge spends a lot of extra money going into the vote to make people think that the people in charge are doing a better job than they actually are. And then they have to suck some of that liquidity out after the election is over. Otherwise, you get dislocations from too aggressive government spending. 2017 might be different in that way because so much of the world is growing at below trend rates that a lot of economists and a lot of politicians are calling for a new round of really aggressive government spending. So it could be this time, instead of sucking liquidity out in 2017, we ramp it up, you know, and the U.S. decides to run $1 trillion deficits for as far as the eye can see. And the European Central Bank gets on board and the Fed gets on board and China keeps pushing down the value of its currency. We might have finally that crack up boom that fans of the Austrian School of Economics have been talking about as imminent for such a long time. And even if we don't, will have a burst of growth, quote unquote, that causes the commodities markets to get stronger again. You know, Mark Fauber just came out and took back a lot of his gloom and doomy kinds of predictions from the previous year and said, you know what, it looks like commodities are going to start rising again, led by oil, but also most basic materials, because infrastructure is in such a mess in so much of the world that infrastructure spending programs are going to have to be pumped up. And in Asia, that's to bring a lot of Asian countries out of the 19th century and get them ready for 21st century tourism, for instance. In the U.S., it's because, you know, we're basically an old economy now. And we've got a lot of decaying roads and bridges and stuff like that. So the next round of government spending might be focused on infrastructure, because that's something that a broad spectrum of politics agrees with. You know, you got people on the right and left who both think, infrastructure is okay because it's an investment. Yeah. It's not just handing money to people. It's not just giving tax breaks to corporations or welfare payments to deadbeats. It's actually building something that's of some value. So that's the path of least resistance to get a massive new increase in government spending going. And Faber is now on record as predicting that's going to happen in 2017. That's pretty good for inflation hedges like gold and silver, because if we put a lot of new people to work, we'll start getting wage inflation, which is what Janet Yellen is on record as wanting.
Sure.
High pressure economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so. Hey, I mean, this is what it's about here. This is what they live for, right? I mean, let's face it. This is what they've been doing for a long time. At least, well, remember the last time we tried this was the Porculus stimulus and it bought us absolutely nothing. So problem is in the U.S., we got all these unions, prevailing wage. So nothing gets built properly on time. It doesn't really help the economy that much. But at least you can see where your money's going, right?
Well, infrastructure helps if it's done right. But the way it works in a democracy is that it's done politically, right? Because every single congressman demands a piece of the pie for his constituents.
Of course.
And so the money gets divided up in ways that in a free market probably wouldn't happen, because it just goes to the guys who have the most pull. Like
the bridge to nowhere.
The government.
Right? Like your bridge to nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because that put a lot of people to work while they were building it, you know, and who cares what happens afterwards, because the congressman is going to retire at some point and they're going to name that bridge after him or a road or something like that and give him a nice pension. And he doesn't care that the debt related to that has been ladled onto our grandchildren's accounts. So that's the way it'll work. And we saw how it plays out in China, where the Chinese central government basically just made lots of credit available. And then all these regional agencies decided to build little empires for themselves where they get a whole new airport and name it after the guy who's the head of the regional funding mechanism. And nobody flies in and out of that airport. Yeah. Roads with no cars and entire ghost cities. That's the extreme case. Ours wouldn't be quite as bad because we got a relatively free press that would be paying attention to this, but still, it takes a really long time for people to find out.
It's less free and less free. Look at WikiLeaks. The press has not even mentioned it. They've avoided it like the plague. It's been like the alternative press, like you and me and others who've brought it to the public's attention. But the press is, hey, as long as it's their guys who are stealing, they don't seem to care.
Well, of course. And if it's government spending, a lot of people in the media who skew liberal, of course, see most government spending as a good thing just conceptually. It puts people to work and it improves lives and it generates growth and it increases aggregate demand, the Keynesian holy grail. Yeah. You know, it gets people buying stuff with borrowed money most of the time. Mm-hmm. And that's seen as a good thing in and of itself. You know, Paul Krugman has that great saying that he has two, I think. One is that if we got invaded by aliens, that would be good for the economy because we'd have to increase military spending. And since that's government spending, that'll create more jobs. And the other is that if we just dug a big hole and shoveled cash into it, that would also be a good thing. You know, if we're paying people to shovel the cash, then that's government jobs. And so these guys think in those terms and they don't think further ahead to the consequences of the debt that we're taking on. So, you know, as Keynes is quoted as saying way back when, in the long run, we're all dead.
Yeah.
So but of course, we're living in that long run now. We're living in Keynes's long run, and we're suffering the consequences of all the unwise borrowing from decades past. And our kids are really going to suffer from the unwise borrowing that's coming, you know, and there's no way around this, no way around the reckoning that comes from this flawed model being put into place around our experiment with communism. You know, Karl Marx had a really attractive sounding model back when and an interesting analytical framework for looking at how capitalism works. But the tragedy of Marxism is that it actually got put into practice.
Yeah.
And it turned out not to work at all in practice. So now we don't use his completely valid analytical framework the way we should, you know, which looks at who controls the means of production and how much power is flowing to them at the expense of the peasants, you know. Keynesianism is kind of the same thing, where it sounds nice. Government should act as a stabilizer. And when markets, which are inherently unstable, flake out, government should step in and pick up the slack to increase aggregate demand back to long-term trend. And that sounds really good to people because especially liberals envision themselves running a government staffed by people who are like them, you know, so they see that as an inherently good process. But of course, it doesn't work because it requires huge amounts of new debt to be taken on, which then have to be covered at some point, which slow down growth, which lead to even bigger government programs, which take on more debt and so on until the debt becomes unmanageable and the system collapses. We're getting there.
Yeah, we're Gary. Getting there.
That day is coming.
Yeah, we don't know when exactly, but it's barring some type of miracle, it's coming for sure. So yeah, so probably we'll look at public works programs and who knows, maybe they'll start building new post offices while they're at it because we need them so much, right? It's the kind of useful things that they come up with, John.
We will start building all kinds of stuff, yes. And post offices will probably be part of it because that is really labor intensive, what the post office does.
Yeah.
So in the Keynesian model, you get a lot of bang for your immediate buck by upgrading a post office that allows you to hire a few more people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll see stuff like that. In other words, as you're saying, it will be mostly yesterday's technologies that we're going to be throwing money at.
Right.
And so
green energy.
In any event, we won't get too much bang for our buck because we don't, as a government, don't understand how to build out a fiber optics network or something like that. That's beyond the scope of most congressmen. And so what we'll do is we'll build things that that we understand and we won't get a lot of cash flow from them.
No, nope. But at least if they build roads, they can put up some more toll booths and Easy Pass scanning stations, so they'll get money from that. Like in Florida here, they just build the HOV lanes, or now they don't bother with that. They just build the, you know, congestion lanes, express lanes. So you pay for the express lanes to avoid the traffic. And, you know, sometimes like they weren't supposed to initially do this, but during the middle of the day, there'll be an accident in the regular lanes. And the price in the express lane should be 50 cents or a dollar. It'll go up to $7.50 because they'll be profiting from the accident in the regular
surge
lanes.
Pricing. Well, yeah. they got that from Uber.
Yeah, well, maybe Uber got that from them. I'm not sure. But it's just out and out thievery. So that's the kind of things that we look at here. So anyway, check out John's work over at dollarcollapse.com. We're the latest on what's happening with the economic collapse. Check out financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for the newsletter. The revamped site is working unbelievably well, thanks to our webmaster, Stefan. And any emails, just send them kl@carrylutz.com. John, we will touch base with you next week.
Thanks, Carrie. Talk to you then.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.